Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Whispers in the Willows is an anthology-style true crime book that chronicles three unsolved murders, a series of death row executions, and the harrowing stories of two Holocaust survivors. A 22-year-old college student, Rebecca Gould, vanished from a friend's house September 20, 2004, near the town of Melbourne, Arkansas. Her partially clothed, bludgeoned body was found near a rural road not far from the house a week later. Her case has never been solved. It's been profiled on the Dr. Oz Show and was featured on the Hell and Gone podcast in 2018. Jared has written about her case since the day she vanished. There's a glaring amount of evidence in the case that points in several directions, and he has dedicated another chapter about her in his newest work. Amanda Tuzing, a 20-year-old aspiring veterinarian, left her fiancé's home on a rain-soaked night. A few hours later, she would be dead, and her case has baffled law officers for almost 20 years. Karen Johnson Swift was a mother of four that vanished just before Halloween 2011 in Dyersburg, Tennessee. Her body was found in a cemetery a couple of months later. Her killer remains free. Four men who committed unspeakable acts of violence and torture were set to die on death row in April 2017. Jared was there for the planned execution and gives a detailed look into one of the darkest places on earth. The book also includes two Holocaust survivors and their tales of survival. The murders they witnessed cannot be imagined. Jared has also written two other true crime books, Witches in West Memphis and The Creekside Bones. Those books included chapters about the internationally famous West Memphis 3 case. Jared wrote more stories about the West Memphis 3 case than any other journalist in the world and includes death row interviews with Damien Eccles. The book that we're featuring this evening is Whispers in the Willows. Who killed Rebecca Gould? Who killed Amanda Tuzing? And why? With my special guest, journalist and author, George Jared. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, George Jared.
I'm happy to be here, Dan.
Thank you very much for joining us once again. Incredible book. Let's begin this with June 14th, 2000, in Jonesboro, Arkansas. And we're talking about Amanda Tuzing, 20-year-old, and she was living in the town of Dell. Tell us a little bit about Amanda Tuzing and a little bit of her life before we just talk about what happened that fateful night.
Well, Amanda was a college student. She grew up in the town of Dell, like you mentioned. She had a twin brother. She was kind of small in stature. She was about 5'1", and her brother was nearly a foot taller than her. She was the captain of her basketball team when she was in high school. She was an aspiring vet, and she was taking classes to kind of reach that goal. And around the time that she vanished, she had become engaged to her fiance, Matt. And the night that she disappeared, she was at his house, and there was a terrible thunderstorm rolling through the area. And she had decided to go home that night to her parents' house because they lived closer to her college. And the town of Dell at that time was about an hour's drive.
Right. Now, you write that she had promised to call her boyfriend when she got back, got to her parents' house, but no call came. And boyfriend, fiancé, was alarmed. So he called her father, Ed Tuzing. What did they do
Yes.
after this conversation?
Well, Ed and the twin brother left from Dell, the house in Dell, and they started back towards Jonesboro, and then Matt left from Jonesboro, and as they're driving through the night, they meet up about midway, and midway was a little town called Monette, and in Monette, underneath a streetlight, they saw her car underneath this light, and when they got to the car, the keys were in the ignition. The seat was moved all the way forward, which was her preferred sitting position in the car. There was a cold beverage in the console. The car was in perfect mechanical working order. Windshield wipers were in mid-flap when they turned it on. There was nothing in the car to indicate that anything violent had happened to her. Everything was in its place in that car except for her.
Right. Now, you say there was an intensive search. And, of course, the car was examined by the Craighead County Sheriff's Department and obviously determined there was no mechanical issues with the car. Now, the lead detective is Gary Etter. What did they also determine from looking at this car, and what did they determine in terms of very valuable information regarding moving forward?
Well, the thing about it is they knew that it was in good mechanical working order, so she didn't stop her car because there was something wrong with it. It's kind of out in the middle. It's a rural area, so it's kind of out in the middle of nowhere, so there was really no reason to stop in that spot. And so, and there wasn't any indication of a violent struggle. So the thinking was that it was possibly like a guy who was pretending to be a police officer, or she was compelled to stop her vehicle for some reason, and then, you know, maybe somebody held a gun up to her or did something that would scare her to the point where she would exit the vehicle without trying to fight back.
Mm-hmm. Now, how many days after her disappearance is she found? And tell us about that discovery.
So about three to four days, they led a very intensive search effort in eastern Craighead County and then into Mississippi County. And a lot of your listeners, if they're big John Grisham fans, he was born in Jonesboro. And his family, their family farm, a lot of things that he talks about in some of his books about Southern culture, it all came right from this very area where she was found. Her car, where it was found, was only a couple miles from his family farm. So what happened was, it was a Sunday after she disappeared, and a couple were out driving near some tributaries of the St. Francis River, and a woman thought she saw a pair of pants floating in the tributary. It turned out not to be a pair of pants. It did turn out to be a pair of pants, but there was a body in those pants, and it was Amanda Tussin.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, what did they determine from that autopsy, fingernails, underneath, DNA, toxicology report? What do they determine from all of those tests?
They determined that she had died, that she had drowned, or she had suffered a condition that was like drowning. And the reason I word it that way is because I don't think there was a great deal of water found in her lungs. But sometimes when you're plunged underwater, a mucus plug will form in your throat, and so not a lot of water gets through. But if you can't get rid of the mucus plug on your own, you will essentially die because you're in the water and you can't get the mucus plug out. So it's basically like drowning, and that's what the autopsy report said. There wasn't a lot of detailed information given out as far as the condition of her body when it was found. There was a definitive conclusion, though, that she wasn't raped or sexually assaulted, and she was still, it's odd because she was still wearing the hat on her head when they found her body that she had put on her head when she left her fiance's house. So it was just, it's just odd.
What did they determine in terms of whether this person may be a transient serial killer as a possibility? Or was there some determination that he might be a local person? What was their decision there?
They were able to rule out transient serial killer pretty early on for one simple reason. The place where her body was dumped was extremely remote and only known to a few locals. I mean, even people who live in that area very rarely are able to get into this area where they found that, where they were able to determine that her body had actually been dumped in the into this tributary. So pretty early on, they knew it was a local. They suspected it was a local, and then so they started interviewing some people, possible people of interest. Of course, you know, the fiance would be automatically the first one interviewed, and he took multiple polygraphs, and you know, and as I talked to Detective Etter, he was pretty firm about the fact that that he was never really considered a suspect ever, because he had no motive to do it. He was the first one to immediately notify the family. I mean, she left his house, and within 2 hours, they had found her car. And it takes about an hour to get there, so he only gave her an hour. And, you know, Dan, you're driving through a thunderstorm. You know, you've driven through storms before that, you know, it could take you a long time to get somewhere. So he was immediately worried and notified her family. So he was eliminated as a suspect. There was some thought that maybe, you know, there's drugs or trafficked in a pretty high rate through there. And so there was some thought that maybe it was a case of mistaken identity, and that maybe, you know, that some druggies had pulled her over. But the problem is that in a situation like that, you know, I've covered things like that before. Typically, that's just a gunshot. You know, they would just shoot someone. They wouldn't be going through all the trouble of, you know, taking them out to the middle of nowhere and throwing them into the bayou.
Right. Now, in this, incredible involvement with this case is that this lead detective, Etter, a 48-year law enforcement veteran, he learned that you were trying to track down Mandy's family, and so hence he tracked you down. Now, from what are some of the things that you guys discussed and some of his conclusions regarding who might have done this and why?
He was very involved in this case. I mean, you know, you hear a lot of circumstances where detectives are on a case for many, many years, an unsolved case, and, you know, they say they're working on it, but in all reality, we know they're not, you know. Mm-hmm. But that's not the case with Gary. Gary had been on this case. He constantly communicated with the Tussing family. He told me, I think, like once a week he might even talk to the mom. And so he really worked this case hard. The thing that I think even now, one other detail I might need to mention to your listeners that we haven't discussed yet, one other detail was found on her body, and that it in her front pocket of her jeans was her license.
Right.
And
right.
So I think you can logically deduce from everything that we know about what happened to Mandy that she that there was some type – there was either a police officer or someone impersonating a police officer who was responsible for stopping her.
Now, you do provide an example of why you say this, too, and you talk about the blue light rapist in Arkansas for just 2 years before Mandy's death. Why do you include this? Tell us why you include this, and tell us a little bit about this blue light rapist to lend credibility to your theory.
Well, the reason I included the blue light rapist is because it was a phenomenon that happened in the late 1990s. There was a guy who was convicted for, you know, stopping women and raping them using a blue light. And so that story was still just out there in the culture, I guess you could put it that way. And so
right.
There was a thought that maybe somebody was copycatting this blue light rapist. The problem is that she wasn't raped, and this never happened again. So, and the guy, the original blue light rapist, had been in prison for a couple of years. But I think that there was a lot of there's a big reticence for people to say that an actual police officer did this for obvious reasons. You know, you don't want to make a call like that if it's not true for sure.
No.
But the problem is that all the motivations for someone impersonating that blue light rapist, well, he didn't do any of those things. So there had to be another motivation.
Certainly, certainly. So in terms of speculation, what else did this investigation try to find, and where did it go in terms of trying to discover who this killer was?
Well, where it went was they started interviewing police officers who lived in that area. And in that general area of those two counties. And so they brought multiple officers in. They interviewed them because even early on in the investigation, it was pretty obvious that it was a police officer. I think that they thought that, you know, Edder literally directly quoted to me. He said there was no doubt in his mind that when Mandy stopped her car in her back windshield, she saw, you know, red and blue lights. So pretty early on, you know, but again, we go back to even just the police reports from that time in that area. There was no one was reporting, you know, anybody being stopped by somebody using lights like that. No one had seen anything like it. So, you know, the most likely scenario is that she was stopped by a police officer.
Now, in this same county, Craighead County, there was a deputy from Black Oak, which is a nearby community, small community, where he lived and a few miles from where Mandy's car was found. Tell us a little bit about the investigation into Johnny Williams.
He was interviewed multiple times. He lived only a couple of miles from where her car was found. And I note some of this stuff in my book. You know, I would try to get information. You know, I would get on social media, Facebook and whatnot, and I would just ask the public for, you know, do you have any information about this guy? Well, I started researching another murder case that he was might have been connected to, and almost immediately I started getting messages from just scores of people, women, who say that they had been harassed by him at night along that same stretch of highway. And, I mean, the number of messages was just, it was unbelievable. I mean, and so it got to a point, and I tell people this, you know, obviously you can't trust a lot of the things you read on social media posts, but just the sheer number of people who contacted me, you can still form a conclusion that at the very least there was a thought in that part of the world that he was harassing female motorists at night. And he also had this connection to a murder 20 years previous where a woman had been taken out of her car and shot and left on the side of the road. And so there was a thought that maybe, you know, he might be involved, and eventually he was released from his duties as a deputy with the Craighead County Sheriff's Department.
You write that you were told by law enforcement what regarding Williams and his potential guilt?
They were very, they didn't want to pin it on one of their own for sure, but he was definitely the primary suspect in the case. And there's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. He was their main focus, I know several people, I know several of his relatives, and it's something that was discussed, you know, in their family quite a bit. And literally there were, you know, a couple of times before he died where literally officers tried to go into the hospital room to try to get him to confess to it before he passed on, but he didn't.
Mm-hmm. You write about another case here with, again, with Edder involved. And you talk about a young girl disappearing in 2013, Jessica Williams, playing in her yard with her puppy.
Yes.
Why do you include this story? And tell us the gist of this story that you include.
I included that story because, Dan, I always try to be fair. In that case, it was a slam dunk. The 17-year-old had confessed to murdering this 11-year-old girl who disappeared out of her yard playing one day. He was a neighbor. He even helped her dad look for her that night, and then they found her body in a ditch the next day, not far from the house. Well, then within probably 24-hour period, he had confessed to her murder, gave some details that actually were somewhat accurate to a degree. But I always explain to people, you know, if I tell you that they found somebody, you know, in a river, you know, dead, you know, it's pretty, you could just guess some of the details, you know, just based on just regular experience. So this guy languished in jail for 8 or 9 months, and then they found one sperm cell on her body, and it didn't match him. It matched another neighbor who had come home early from work, and this guy had kids that were her age and played with her, And he obviously has no explanation as to why his sperm cell was on her. So eventually the murder charges were dropped against the 17-year-old, and eventually this other guy, Freddie Sharp III, was convicted. And I included it because up until the sperm cell was tested, everybody knew or everybody thought it was this other guy. And so to be fair to Mr. Williams and his family, you know, he was never convicted in a court of law. So he deserves, you know, that much. But also he deserves that much respect to that degree. But also I also wanted to write about Amanda's case because no one's ever been named as a suspect in her murder. It's been nearly 20 years. And she deserves justice, too.
Absolutely. Now, another part of your book, and very interesting, the scope or the range that you have in this book, Mary, a little bit unusual. The death row tales, why do you include those? And tell us a little bit about these death row tales and some of the people that you encountered and your encounters at death row.
Well, you know, death row is one of those places that very few people ever get to visit. It's kind of a unique experience. I've been there several times, you know, to interview people who were on death row. And then obviously I included a couple chapters about these guys, these four that were, you know, that were sentenced to die in April of 2017. Originally, the state of Arkansas had planned on killing eight because their, you know, cocktail of drugs was about to expire. And so, but four of them were stayed. But then Liddell Lee, you know, who had been accused of killing several women, raping them, his crimes are pretty heinous, pretty brutal. He finally was set to die in April of 2017. He was going to be the first one. You know, I went down to cover it, you know, and of course this whole thing made international news because, you know, killing eight people in a span of about 2 weeks was just about unprecedented in U.S. history. And, you know, there was a lot of celebrities who, you know, opposed it. Damien Eccles from the West Memphis Three, you know, and I write about that. He came back to Arkansas because he would have been one of the eight. He would have been one of those that would have been executed in that batch. And Johnny Depp came with him and spoke at a rally in Little Rock to try to stop this from happening. But, so now Liddell Lee's execution did go forward. I tell people this. Neil Gorsuch had just been appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court. He cast the deciding vote on the last stay to save Liddell Lee's life. So had Neil Gorsuch been confirmed 2 weeks later, these guys might have, several of them might have survived. So it's literally timing. So, I mean, it's one or two first votes that Neil Gorsuch ever cast as a Supreme Court justice. So anyway, the execution went off. Of course, there were, you know, just rallies all around the prison and people just really upset, you know, who are anti-death penalty. And I tell people it's hard for me sometimes because I, you know, sometimes I think it's wrong for a government to be executing its own people. Right. And then I go and I have to talk to family members of these horribly murdered people, and it's tough. I mean, you hear some of these stories, and then you hear them or see them in the courtroom having to hear what happened to their loved one. I mean, I watched a grandmother one time, and she was a very, very old woman. And, I mean, I never saw a lady run out of a courtroom as fast as she did when they started talking about what happened to her granddaughter. I mean, it was just brutal. So that's literally an issue I can be for or against literally within two breaths.
Yes. We can't go into all of them, but you do use a glaring example of why people are for the death penalty in terms of when they hear the description of the crime. But what I want to include this story is the heroic and intelligent thing that the neighbor did in response. This Liddell Lee and Deborah Rose, 26 years old, from Jacksonville, Arkansas, February 9th, 1993. Tell us about this story and, again, the heroic, intelligent neighbor.
Liddell Lee, and this is just one of the just – it's a heartbreaking story.
Yeah.
And what happened was is this woman was, you know, in her house talking to her mom, and this guy knocks on her door, and he wants to borrow some tools. And it's Liddell Lee. And she said she didn't have any tools, and her mom only lived like five houses down, and this was in a kind of an urban setting. So you feel a little safer, I guess. Well, she calls her mom, says, this guy's really creeping me out. And she's like, okay, well, why don't you just come over to my house? And she said, okay, I will here in a little bit. Well, she didn't get the chance. He broke into her house, and he took, I believe it was like a tire thumper. It's one of those tire checkers. And he literally beat this woman to death. And he stole $300 from her so he could go pay his rent-a-center bill. And, just unbelievable. And, a neighbor watched him go into the house and then come back out. So the neighbor notified the police, and so they were able to catch him pretty early. And one thing about it, through DNA and some other stuff, he had also been involved in at least two other murders, one involving a prostitute and then another woman who was kidnapped out of her house in front of her young child. And she was raped and murdered. They found her body in a trailer house somewhere. And those cases were years before that. And so, that was back in a time when, you don't have DNA and all the fancy forensics we have now to solve cases like that. So, but later on, they were able to tie him to those other cases through forensics.
Yeah, incredible. It's also incredible that through this beginning of this argument that ensued, her daughter, Ashley, was 6 years old and her son was two. But especially Ashley witnessed this. They saw their mother on the floor, six-year-old and two-year-old, but didn't respond to her, didn't know what to do, till her sister-in-law came the next day and discovered the body, the horrific sight, and then from there, just, again, a very, very heartbreaking story. And then he's linked to other murders, as you say. Tell us about these stays of execution and just everyone's reaction when these happen. Of course, we know these protests are going on. There's two camps, completely diverse ideas. Tell us more about your experience on death row.
Well, it's a funny thing. You get on the death row unit and everybody's kind of, I hate to use the term, but there is anticipation. You're a journalist, Dan, you understand. You cover horrible and terrible things at times in your career. But it is, I don't want to use the word exciting, but there is definitely a level of anticipation. And I wrote about this. It's really strange being in that room because you've got all these journalists literally from all over the world, CNN, BBC, New York Times, everybody's there. And when the appointed time comes, when the execution hour arrives, they take the witnesses who are going to witness the execution, journalism witnesses, and they take them out. So when they get taken out, you're like, okay, it's getting closer. We're within maybe a half an hour of the execution actually happening. And then a spokesman will come in and say, a circuit court somewhere has stayed the execution for another hour, 2 hours to consider some matters. And I just, I talked to a journalist from CNN, and I talked about her in my book, Jade Garcia, and she just said, this is just a really bad way to do this. I mean, how should, even as horrible and heinous as Liddell Lee was in his life, he shouldn't be sitting there on every hour wondering if he's going to live or die in the next few minutes. I mean, but when they decide to perform one of these executions, all those other appeals need to have been, it needs to be completely exhausted and then have the execution. I don't know how we can get to a point where the system can operate that way, because essentially what you're doing is you're torturing him the whole time. And you're not just torturing him, you're torturing the victim's family, because they a lot of them want to see justice done too. And then if they feel like it gets denied if this guy somehow gets a stay. So I don't know. I just think that there's got to be a better way to do this.
Yeah. Let's get to the story of Karen Johnson Swift, October 29th, 2011. She's slated to go to a Halloween party in Dyersburg, Tennessee. And Karen and her friend are going to attend. She has an oldest daughter. Tell us what those arrangements are, and tell us also her marital status at that time to David Swift. Tell us about this.
Well, Karen was a mother of four. She had two college-age sons, and then she had two grade school-age daughters, all with her husband, David Swift. They had moved to Dyersburg a few years before. They'd had some, and I've talked to David Swift about this, they had had some, marital strife at some point. And on October 10th of that year, she had filed for divorce, but they were still living in the same house. No reports of any type of domestic violence or anything that I'm aware of. And so, you know, it's kind of one of those situations where they still had the two girls. You know, they're obviously going to have to sell their house and do all these other stuff if they're going to get divorced. Well, on October 30th of that year, she decided to go to a party with a friend. And they go to this party where her oldest daughter had gone to stay the night at a friend's house. Well, she called and said she didn't want to stay, and she asked her mom if she could come pick her up. And so she did, and they went back to the house, and the daughter reported, you know, she told the police that when she went to bed, her mom, it was around 2 o'clock in the morning, her mom was laying right next to her. Well, the next morning, Karen's car is found about a mile or so from the house. And I believe I'm right about this. It appeared that maybe there was a nail in one of the tires, one of the tires was flat or something like that. And again, the car was in perfect mechanical working order. And she was gone. She vanished. You know, David Swift, from every indication, was cooperative with police. He told them, you know, I actually don't know what he told them because they've never released that, and he's never spoken about it publicly. But he was interviewed a few times. The daughter was interviewed a couple times. And she was just gone. There were search parties looking for her. She was a very attractive woman. She was blonde-headed, blue-eyed. She matched kind of a description of several women who had died in Western Tennessee around that time. You'll probably remember the Holly Bobo case. That was pretty big. And so there was kind of a thought process that maybe there was a transient serial killer out, you know, targeting women with blonde hair and blue eyes who kind of fit this athletic build, you know, that type of description. So that was floating around for a while. Well, then about 2 months, about a month and a half after she disappeared, they found her body at a cemetery about 8 miles away. Her body had been placed under some kudzu bushes, and when the bushes died off as the seasons changed, parts of her body were exposed, and so they knew officially she had been murdered.
Now, what about Zachary Adams and his three cohorts, Jason, Autry? How do these people get involved? What's their story?
Well, what I did is, because the thing about this case, there was so little information, and there was this prevailing thought that there was a guy or someone targeting women that looked like this. And Holly Bobo's case was the most famous. And these guys that you just mentioned, they're the guys who were charged and convicted in her killing eventually. This was several years. I believe it was 2014-ish. Actually it was later than that. I think they may have just been charged then. But anyway, I included, you know, just the gruesome description about how they, this story came out that they had kidnapped Holly Bobo from her house, and they drugged her, and then they brutally raped her, and then they killed her. But when they went to go down her body, they were going to gut her, and she sort of woke up and had to shoot her again. And so the story isn't super clear. A couple of the people, at least one guy that was convicted in it, says he didn't do it. He had no connection to it. But I included that story because the honest truth is we don't really have any suspects in Karen's case. And so this was a prevailing theory or thought that there were other cases, too, of women disappearing in Western Tennessee that fit that description. So that's kind of why I included that.
But there were statements made by these people, allegedly, from people that were close to them. Again, not jailhouse informants, the kind of people that spoke out against them and called police. Like Adam's girlfriend said he would do the same thing to her if she didn't obey him. And these people, despite the lack of DNA or forensic evidence, Adams was convicted and sentenced to life. Isn't that true?
Absolutely. There were several statements made by family members related to those guys. And like you said, a girlfriend also made a statement that he told her, you know, that the same thing would happen to her. It's a very compelling case. It's a strange case. There was even for a while, even Holly's own brother was a suspect for a while because he woke up and noticed this guy what the deal was is she was getting ready to go to nursing school that morning, and the brother looks out the window around the time that she's leaving and notices that she's being confronted by a guy. And then he thinks it's her boyfriend. And so he doesn't think anything of it. Well, then she's led off into the woods and then gone. And he calls his mother, or his mother called the house at that time. And he said, well, there's this guy with Holly. And the mother immediately told him, you need to call the police right now and go get her. Go get a gun and shoot him. And whoever this guy is. And, and so because the story was just kind of incoherent, you know, from his from the brother's standpoint, he was a suspect for a while. So is the Holly Bobo case is a really strange case.
Mm-hmm. You say that the case is definitely linked to the Karen Johnson Swift case. And you write also there was no sign of Karen until December 10th, 2011. What happens then and what is determined from that, if anything?
Well, after that, the police came to David Swift's home a couple more times. They did another search. They did an I believe they interviewed him at least one more time. Well, then he just shut it down. He hired an attorney, and pretty much that was the end of that. The biggest problem that I've had in the Karen Johnson Swift case is that the police have released nothing. I mean, they have not released any information out of their case file. It's hard to get them, you know, if you go over there, it's almost impossible to meet with anybody, you know, a prosecutor or the sheriff who, is overseeing the case. And it's just, it's been frustrating. I'm not going to lie because, you know, the case is, you know, 8-9 years old now. No one's been convicted. You know, this woman did have 4 kids. I'm sure, you know, her grade school daughters are, you know, high school age now. And there's nothing been released. There's never been a suspect named, nothing. You know, a lot of fingers have pointed at the dad, you know, her husband, and you know, David, and you know, but there's no proof that he did it. So I mean, there's an old Southern term, we're up against it right now.
What does Karen's mother think about David Swift's involvement?
I've tried to talk to her a few times. She's been a little reticent to talk to me. That's understandable. I've come across that a lot through the years. You know, sometimes the victims, you know, families want to talk and sometimes they don't. And literally, she has never spoken to me, but she has made public statements to several TV stations that she thinks that David, you know, at the very least knows what happened to her daughter. So, you know, and that's her belief. And hopefully one of these days I'll get the chance to sit down and talk with her and we can go over that a little bit more.
Right. Let's use this as an opportunity, George, to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, which is Honey. I like shopping online for the convenience mostly, and it saves time for me, but I was overpaying online until I found Honey. I'm not sure exactly how Honey does it, but Honey saves me money on things I want and need to buy. Imagine how much money you could save, too. I ordered last week Michael Benson's Haunting Homicides. He's an upcoming guest on the program. And the cheapest I could find the book, paperback, was $20 U.S. Through Honey, magically, somehow, almost $3 in savings. Now, that's about a half a dozen or more true crime books when you look at how much Honey has saved. 10 million people are already saving with Honey. Has over 100,000 plus 5-star reviews on Google Chrome Store. Time Magazine called Honey basically free money. When I mentioned that the book was $20 and I got the deal through Honey, I almost saved $3 off this. Imagine how much you could save when, for example, Honey saves people an average of $125 per year. There's really no reason not to use Honey. It's free to use, installs on your computer in just 2 clicks, and it'll save you money so you can treat yourself to something nice. Get Honey for free at joinhoney.com/murder. That's joinhoney.com/murder. Now, George, we were talking about the next part of your book, and you felt it important, and I agree with you, to put a couple stories in, a couple harrowing stories of survivors of the Holocaust. Tell us a little bit about Henry Greenbaum and his family, Paige, and all the children. Tell us, as you do in the book, about Henry Greenbaum.
So, Dan, I do a lot of interviews. I have in the past with Holocaust survivors. I always tell young journalists when I go to speak at universities or even high schools, there are some types of interviews that you're only going to get one chance at because those people are going to be gone. And, you know, right now it's a lot of World War II vets and Holocaust survivors, people who really experienced it. I mean, I've known a few Holocaust survivors I've interviewed who were really young kids when it happened and they don't really remember. That was not Henry Greenbaum. He told probably the most tragic story I've ever heard out of a Holocaust survivor, which is saying a lot. Henry was a typical kid growing up in Poland. He had a mom, dad, bunch of sisters, had some brothers, you know, played soccer, just a regular guy. And then, of course, he was probably, I think he was 10-ish, maybe 11, when Germany invaded on September 1st, 1939. And so within a few months, him and his family are living. Actually, his father passed away right before the invasion suddenly. And then what he did is he got his kids jobs working at a munitions factory because they knew the invasion was coming. And it was just a matter of time. So he thought that there was a belief in the Jewish community there that if you worked in a munitions factory, you would be spared because you'd be seen as a valuable worker. So the family, you know, worked in the munitions factory there in or near the ghetto in Warsaw. Well, then slowly but surely, you know, these people, as the years progressed, they were meted out to all these, you know, concentration camps. And, you know, Henry watched, I believe it was at least 4 or 5 of his sisters just murdered, basically murdered. You know, I think a couple of them died from disease, but it was caused by the conditions in the camps. But his sister, Phage, is probably the most absolutely horrific. So at this point, you know, his mom, his sister who had 2 children, he watched them be placed in a line, which obviously they were headed to the crematoria, you know, within minutes they were going to die. And so he'd watched this happen, and then him and his sister Phage decided they were going to leave. And so Phage had talked to a Jewish police officer in this camp that they were in, and they were going to make a run for it. And so there were some insurgents outside the camp who were supposed to turn the lights off so they could make it through. Well, the lights did go off, and so Phage and Henry and this police officer, they went to this place in the fence where they dug a hole. Well, then the lights suddenly came on. The reason the lights were off wasn't because the power had been cut. It was because there were Allied bombers in the area, and so they were shutting them down so they wouldn't notice the target area. So the lights come on. The bullets start flying. Henry is shot in the head, and he runs towards the female barracks. He's pretty sure his sister got shot at this point. Wasn't completely sure. Well, he goes to the female barracks. They don't want to let him in because they tell him, if we let you in here, we'll all die. They'll kill all of us right now. And so finally he got to one female barracks, so they were able to put some rags on his head to kind of clean up his wound. And so he was able to make it back to his barrack. And so the next morning during roll call, he's out there and he's looking for his sister, and then he finally spots her. She had made it across, just across the fence line, and all he could see across the fence line was her blonde hair. And that was the end of her. And literally when he's telling these stories, he was 83 when I interviewed him. And, I mean, it's almost impossible. Like, I read that chapter that I wrote about Henry. I taught a creative writing class for a teacher's co-op this summer. And I just read him that chapter to kind of break up the class time, and literally the tears in that room were everywhere. I mean, it was just, it's awful. I mean, I've interviewed a lot of Holocaust survivors. Every one of their stories is bad. His was just the worst.
It was incredible, too. Just one of the vivid images that comes out is that they stole some garbage. The two of them stole some garbage, he and a friend, to eat. And then the next time that friend dared to do that again and steal some more garbage, he was hung by his neck for stealing that garbage. Just a very vivid scene.
Yes.
In that story.
Yeah, that boy was murdered because he was eating trash.
It is incredible, though, the Allies rescuing these people finally, and otherwise we would never have these stories. But these people had no idea. I mean, in the one story you have is that there was talk of, after this person had seen their entire family killed, basically, if not their whole family, then finally they heard that the Allies were coming, the war would end pretty soon, and that day did come, didn't it?
It did. It's always an interest. It's one of these things in history, I write a lot of stories about history too. Just as a side note, when I'm not writing about true crime and stuff like that. But one interesting thing that I've always wondered about is why the Allies didn't take out some of these concentration camps, like the crematorias. You know, they were bombing a lot of these places, and a good for instance is Auschwitz itself, because Auschwitz, there was a major there were major factories around Auschwitz that those concentration camp, the people in the concentration camp were working in, and several of those factories were bombed. Well, and a couple of them, they were very close to that concentration. It was only a few miles away, and I always wondered why they didn't just take out the crematorias. I mean, I know that some innocent people would be killed, but innocent people were being killed in the factories when they were getting bombed too. So that couldn't have been what stopped them. I almost want to think, Dan, that the reason that the Allies didn't go to the lengths to stop, I really think that they wanted the full scope of the atrocity. I think they wanted it to come out, like they wanted the images. They wanted people to see just how truly horrific this whole thing was.
Could be right. Could be incredibly right. Let's talk about the curious case, as you title it, the curious case of Rebecca Gould. And you spoke extensively with her sister Danielle, and Dr. Larry, her father as well. Tell us about this disappearance of Rebecca Gould.
Rebecca Gould is the first murder case I ever wrote about as a journalist. She vanished September 20th. 2004, she had dropped a friend off at work, a guy named Casey McCullough, and she went back to his house to collect her things. She was a college student, and she was headed back to Northwest Arkansas, which is about a four-hour drive from Melbourne, the town that they were in. She goes back to the house, and then she just, like several other women we've talked about today, she just vanishes. And I find out that she's missing on a Wednesday. I head down to the sheriff's department. When I get there, she's got several of her sisters out there, and her mother Shirley's there, and then Dr. Larry Gould, her father's out there, and they hand me a missing poster, and I just start jotting down notes. And basically, she was in college, everything I just told you. So then later on that afternoon, I see the friend being hauled into the sheriff's department to be interrogated. Her boyfriend from high school, he was interviewed, their long-time relationship, he was interviewed at length. And so we spend the next 5 days after this, we're out looking for Rebecca Gould. Well, on Monday, September 27th, I was at the courthouse early in the morning there in Melbourne, and a lady was talking about there being a smell near her home down this very rural road, and there were buzzards in the air. And so I went out there, and of course, Rebecca's body was found out there. She was in a t-shirt and panties. She had been out there for about a week, and she'd been missing a week. So then then the focus turns to trying to find her killer. Well, I wrote about her case periodically through the years, and the police would never release anything in her case. They're very tight-lipped
right
about the investigation and the facts. But on this case, I personally knew some people who had connections to the case in law enforcement and other places. So I was able to mine out some details that to this day they've never publicly released. For instance, she died from a blunt force trauma to the head, two blows. I actually got a copy of her autopsy report. And according to her autopsy report, she wasn't sexually assaulted. There was no semen found, no pubic hairs. Her body, her radiological reports came back. There were no bone bruising on any part of her body. Her breasts were totally normal. There was nothing there. So there was no proof of a sexual assault to this woman at all. And the other, you know, one detail is the fact that she was wearing her panties and a shirt when they found her. You know, the killer's not going to go to the trouble of putting her clothes back on after he raped her. So that kind of eliminated, you know, several potential possible suspects. They didn't find any drugs in her system. And interestingly, in the house, when they went into the house the next day, see, Casey, the boyfriend, he didn't go home that day after work. He went over to a friend's house, and then they went out to a nearby town to watch a movie and go eat dinner and all this other stuff. And then he went back to that house, and he stayed the night there, which was something he never did. Well, the next day, after the family has contacted the sheriff, they go to Casey's work because he's gone straight back to work the next morning, still hasn't gone by his own house. And when they get to the house, everything looked fairly normal. There were two little dogs in the house, a Pomeranian named Lady, and that was Rebecca's dog. And they were perfectly fine. They had messed on the floor. That was about it. Then the officer starts looking around some more, and he notices some bloody sheets in the washing machine. He notices the mattress has been flipped. He also notices that the pillows, the bloody pillows on the bed, are stuffed underneath the bed.
Right.
And there's one item missing out of the house, strangely, and it is a loose piano leg. And there was only a few people who knew that the piano leg would come loose. And so, but it was gone, according to all reports. And so, more than likely, she died from one or two blows to the head from that piano leg. Her clothes were in the house, her keys were in the house, her car was there. Of course, and, you know, Dan, I've got a couple of dogs, especially my little one. If you killed me and dragged my body out the door, she's going to follow me. And she's going to be out. You're going to find her outside, or she's going to be dead because she'll bark, you know, she'll go nuts on you. So to me, automatically had to assume that the person who killed Rebecca was familiar with her dog, and she felt comfortable enough to be around them in her panties and her underwear. She wasn't raped. There were no drugs or alcohol found in her system. So obviously, from my vantage point, I thought it was a love interest of some kind. Well, I wrote about this case for years. The police kept saying that her, you know, sort of ex-boyfriend, Casey, was not a suspect. He had an ironclad alibi. Well, in 2016, I wrote about her case in my first book, Witches in West Memphis, which is mostly about the West Memphis Three, but I included a chapter about her. And I reconnected with her father, Dr. Larry Gould, and so we started, you know, writing and trying. You know, he had a couple of private investigators that he had dealt with. We even had a documentary filmmaker at one point who was real interested in maybe doing a documentary about her case. Well, we would get together at his house, and all of us would be sitting there, and we would have like a board of potential suspects, you know, up, and we would go through all the facts in the case, and, you know, he always kept coming back to Casey. And I was like, no, Doc, there's no way. You know, he's been cleared by the police. It's not him. We're going to have to go in another direction. And but he always kind of was in the back of his mind. Well, about 2 or 3 months after this whole thing started, we kind of hit a wall again. Someone had written an anonymous letter detailing the murder, but the letter was very well written, but it didn't match the autopsy report at all. So I didn't take, you know, I wrote about it, but it was just more of a, let's just get this story out there to try to get the killer to change behavior or something like that. Well, that didn't happen. So I thought, you know, I'm going to reach out to Casey. I'd interviewed him a couple times before. You know, he always would take a call from me, was friendly, you know, never had any problems. Well, I called the Sonic where he used to work to try to get contact information from him because it's a small town. I figured somebody there. I know he didn't work there anymore, but I knew somebody would have contact info for him. Well, unbelievably, his wife was there, his now wife.
Yeah.
And I talked to her, very nice, pleasant woman. We spent probably, you know, 5 to 10 minutes chatting on the phone. He had read the chapter I'd written in my first book about the case, and I you know, I said, you know, my instinct is to think that, no, he didn't do this. The police obviously have some very powerful alibi evidence for him because, Dan, as you can just tell from what I've told you, this unbelievably points towards a love interest doing this. So I called, she gave me a cell phone number and said, contact him through Facebook. Sometimes we don't get a good signal at her house because they still live in the house where Rebecca was murdered, still sleep in the same bedroom. And so I called him, left messages, left Facebook messages, never would answer. So at that point, I'm starting to get a little suspicious about something, you know, because this is a change in behavior. So then I get a hold of the wife again. I'm like, hey, I've been trying to get a hold of Casey. He won't ever call me back. And she basically said, he doesn't want to talk to you. We don't want to talk to you. Don't ever contact us again. And she pretty much hung up the phone on me. And mind you, up until this point, I had never written a single word negatively about Casey McCullough. I'd never written a word about him. And so that really shocked me. And I was really – then I started getting suspicious about something. Didn't know what. But so then I – in my second book, I wrote another chapter, and I expressed some of those concerns in that chapter, you know, basically because of his changed behavior. Well, then, a few months after that book came out, I got an email from a woman named Catherine Townsend. She was a reporter for the Discovery Channel, and she wanted to do a story about one of the other murder cases I'd covered in the Creekside Bones, and then she said that she also wanted to do a podcast series on Rebecca's case. And so I agreed to – she came to Arkansas, and I interviewed with her three or four times. And so then in the fall of 2018, the Helen Gone podcast came out. It was an eight-part series. And it detailed Rebecca's case. Well, as this case is getting, you know, retold, the Arkansas State Police start coming under, you know, some heat for, you know, not having garnered a conviction in this case or getting somebody arrested. And so all sorts of details start filtering to the surface that are just kind of hard to believe. For instance, this guy went out with five of his friends that night, and two of the statements that were given by two of his friends, the police actually sent those statements back to them to review them so that they could interview them again.
Incredible.
Which I couldn't believe. I mean, but the statements were damning because in the statements they both said that he was already using the terms missing to describe her, and they both said that he was in love with her, and they couldn't believe he wasn't running out the door to find her. So right there, that's an alarm bell. Alarm bell's going off like crazy. So Danielle, I mentioned her in the book. She's the sister. Her and I, you know, we've become friends. I'll message her, talk to her periodically. Well, Danielle calls the owner of the Sonic or the former owner of the Sonic where Casey works, and asked him if there was video of him work that day, because that was the whole thing, was that there was video evidence that Casey was at work.
Right.
And the owner said no, they missed getting that footage by 3 days, or by a day, because it was one of those systems that recorded over itself every 72 hours. So there's no video of him at work. And so at that point, there's no such thing as an ironclad alibi. So at this point, I'm getting real – this whole thing is just not looking right to me. And then I start hearing that the police had developed a theory early on that she was murdered that afternoon. Well, the only problem I have with that is that inside the house, they found a sandwich biscuit and coffee in the microwave. Rebecca was supposed to pick her sister up at noon, and she was in a T-shirt and panties. A stack of folded clothes were next to the bed. On the bed, next to the bed, somewhere around the bed. It was her clothes. The only other thing missing out of the house that they've never been able to find, or they've never admitted to finding, is her suitcase. So it's pretty obvious just from these, you know, minor details. And her sister, by the way, told me that mid-morning that it was very common for Rebecca to take a shower, take a nap, and to be dressed that way, or watch Regis and Kelly, a show that came on at 9 o'clock in the morning on the ABC affiliate that's over in that area. So this obviously happened in the morning. Even later on, a good friend of mine named Jennifer Buchholz, who did a series of stories about this, She was a counterintelligence officer for the U.S. Army and worked at the Pentagon. She's a very smart, a highly qualified person. Even she did an analysis of the maggot activity in the autopsy report, and she worked at the medical examiner's office in New York City for several years, so she's very familiar with all this stuff. She teaches forensics at the American Military Institute. And even she said, yeah, this happened. It's not an exact or precise science, but she said more than likely this happened before noon on that day.
It's interesting, too, when you talk to Danielle, that originally you had this, again, very vivid scene that they were driving in the car, and she got a call, Rebecca got a call from Casey, and she said to her sister, oh, he wants to be exclusive, and she rolled her eyes. That's what Danielle remembered. She rolled her eyes, and then this event happened afterwards. The other thing I thought was very, very interesting, I don't think we stressed it enough, but I think you do in the book, is that these people that he spent the night with, that he didn't go home, which was, again, he wasn't that type of person, typically. He stayed out at these people's homes. They were surprised that he was wanted to come over there. So it was a surprising, untypical behavior in a couple different ways. Just coincidental that he wouldn't go back to his house where, again, his girlfriend had gone back to the house after she dropped him off. There was all that evidence that she had just gone to a corner store to get something, a biscuit, like you say, and a coffee, and was in her panties. There's more than circumstantial evidence, it seems, especially if you say there isn't a solid alibi, then you were mistaken when you thought the reason why he wasn't charged is because he was cleared.
Yes, and I will admit, as a journalist and even a true crime writer, this was my first rodeo, and I was naive. I actually believed that if the police were not, if he wasn't being named a suspect in this case, if they weren't going after him harder, then they must have some overwhelming, powerful piece of evidence that he was at work, and not involved. And I was wrong, because there is, that evidence doesn't exist. And here's the thing, Dan, this is what you have to believe. If you're going to, this is Rebecca Gould's killer. The killer, first of all, would have to know where this place is. It's out in the middle of nowhere. And I'm talking the middle of nowhere.
Right.
And where her body was found, it was found at the end of an ancient gravel road that was used as a timber road years before, and it connects up to Highway 9, which connects Melbourne to a town called Mountain View. And so literally, and my friend Jennifer Buchholz wrote about this, so the killer left Casey's house, gets on this gravel road, which starts about a mile from his house, and the killer literally is going down these creek beds and all these other places. Her body's found at the very end of the road just before you get back up onto the main highway. It's down an embankment. So what happened to the killer was he was looking for a good place to dump her, and literally that was his last option before getting it back up onto the main highway with a body in the back of a truck or in a trunk. So psychologically, yeah, the killer had to let the body go. And the whoever the killer was, this was a route that was out of town. So it was a route that, if it was somebody, who worked in town, they wouldn't have to go past it. And she said that's another psychological cue, too, because the killer doesn't want to have to relive the stress of driving by that body every day. So this was an out-of-the-way place. You'd have to know this. Well, then the other elements come in. Okay, so the person who killed her more than likely killed her with this loose piano leg. So how did they know the piano leg was loose? Because I don't know about you. I've been in a lot of houses with pianos.
Yeah,
and
not checking legs.
I mean, it's bizarre. Yeah, right. I mean, you're not doing that. And then you go to the motivations of the killer. Well, if one of the detectives has told people that he thinks that there's another guy who's a suspect, and the reason he should be a suspect is because he was sexually obsessed with Rebecca, which there's no evidence of. There's no evidence that he ever even was to the house. And when he was interviewed, he said he didn't even know who Casey McCullough was or where he lived. So there's no evidence pointing towards him, and there's no evidence pointing towards a sex assault. Well, there was cash found in the house, so, there was some rumor going around that Rebecca owed money for drugs or whatever. Well, there were no drugs found in her system at all. There's cash in the house, so how can that be a motivation? Well, then there was another motivation that was talked about, which actually I subscribed to for a long time just because I thought Casey couldn't be a suspect. And that was that this was a rage killing by a female, you know, that because who would clean up the mess, you know? So I thought it has to be a female. Well, then, you know, but there were parts of it that didn't make any sense once I got a copy of the autopsy report, you know, because if it was a female or females that killed her, she's going to have a lot more wounds to her body. You know, this ain't going to be – and Rebecca was feisty. Everybody, every single human being I've ever talked to about that woman said she was feisty, that she would fight you. She would she wouldn't let somebody rape her. She you'd have to take her out. And so now you've got the situation where there's no motive, no clear motive now, unless there was some emotional connection to her that was ending. And yeah. – So you got to believe that, you know, somebody, you know, drove to that house out of the middle of nowhere, just happened to find that piano leg while she's awake and looking right at him, by the way. This is a very small house. And then this person hits her in the head twice, cleans up, throws the sheets in the washing machine, cleans up the baseboards, wipes blood off the back porch, drags her body out the back porch, which is surrounded by a fence with a gate, and then locks the doors behind them because the house was locked up the next day when the police arrived. And here's the other detail that's just simply unbelievable. He admits he went back to the house before he went to work the next morning and saw all of her stuff, everything in the house.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't make sense at all. And also, when you say forensically, no prints and no DNA except from Casey and Rebecca. Again,
right.
You can't
that's
say what that conclusion is, but that's a strong conclusion if no other DNA.
Right. If one of the other suspects in the case is a guy named Chris. I have made this statement before. If his DNA was found at that house, if his fingerprints DNA, says he's never been in that house ever. He has made that statement publicly. I've never been there. I don't know where it's at. So we can deduce just from the simple fact that he hasn't been arrested or the police haven't made a statement saying that he's a suspect, you can automatically assume that there's none of that. And there's also another woman who was a prime suspect in the case, or never named as a suspect, but she was interviewed multiple times. You can also deduce that no forensic evidence connecting her to the crime scene was found there either. And the lead detective in the case has told Dr. Gould before that there's virtually no forensic evidence in this case at all. And he told him this on a day, this lead detective, he actually snuck into a book signing of mine. And he said his quote to me was he wanted to figure out what I knew about this case.
Right.
So when I told him, you know, next time, just, you know, give me a call and I'll tell you, you know.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting, too, how inextricably involved you've become in this case, this one, and on these others, but especially this one with talking to Danielle, her sister, but also Dr. Larry Gould. And at this book signing, you meet him. It's a very dramatic scene, very, very interesting how it even unfolds. And again, at that same book signing, you have this other guy that wants and approaches Larry as well. So very, very interesting, very vivid imagery of your involvement in this. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about Whispers in the Willows, who killed Rebecca Gould, who killed Amanda Tuzing, and why. Thank you very much, George. Is there a Facebook page or website for people that might want to take a look at your other books or these other cases and find out more information?
Dan, if people just want to contact me through Facebook, I'm usually on there quite a bit. And then there's links to my books on there. You can always go to Amazon and get them. Barnes & Noble carries them as well, so you can order through them. Sometimes they'll have them on the shelves in certain places. So, or you know what, if you absolutely want one signed from me, you can contact me through Facebook, and I can get you a signed copy mailed to your house.
Oh, that's great. Fantastic. Again, I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about Whispers in the Willows, who killed Rebecca Gould, who killed Amanda Tuzing, and why. Thank you very much, George Jarrett. You have a great evening.
Dan, you do that yourself.
Thank you. Good night.
Thank you.